Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Ambry Next and Now podcast. My name is Christian Gund, and I'm one of the exome genetic counselors here at Ambry Genetics. So let's say you've got a case that you think would be a good candidate for exome sequencing. Maybe you listened to our previous podcast where we talked about ordering your first exome sequencing, and now you feel you're ready to send one off to us. But maybe there's an administrator or a colleague who still isn't sure about the benefits of exome sequencing. Or maybe you're pushing for coverage with someone from an insurance company. Whoever it is you're dealing with, though, suddenly you need resources showing the clinical effectiveness and cost-effectiveness of exome sequencing. Well, today I'll be taking you through some of the studies, papers, and recommendations that support the use of exome sequencing to help you through your next conversation with a skeptic. Arguably the most straightforward piece of support available is the ACMG policy statement on clinical applications of genomic sequencing that was released in 2012. Now, that paper makes a lot of points, and if you haven't read it, I'd highly recommend seeking it out for yourself. But the part that's relevant to our conversation is that the ACMG recommended exome sequencing for patients where a genetic etiology is considered likely, but either their phenotype does not suggest a specific disorder, or past testing has failed to provide a diagnosis in a disorder that is suspected. They also make the point that if a phenotype has a high degree of genetic heterogeneity and a panel isn't available, an exome may make more sense than testing via a gene-by-gene approach. And this recommendation is great. It's well thought out and highlights some of the situations where exome sequencing is most useful. What if that doesn't convince your exome skeptic, though? What if they're looking for hard numbers or specific studies? Well, there are plenty of studies which show that clinical exome sequencing is effective in finding pathogenic variants. In fact, I did a whole episode discussing Ambry's paper covering our cohort of the first 500 exomes with Kelly Farwell-Hagman, who's the lead author on that paper. I'd recommend listening to that podcast or reading that paper for yourself, of course, but our skeptic would probably be most interested in the fact that our positive rate was above 30% and our positive rate on trios was over 37%. Personally, I'd note that these were our earliest 500 cases, and we've improved on pretty much every aspect of our exome sequencing and analysis since, from capturing to our filtering and analysis, and that as a result, our numbers today would probably be higher. Regardless of where our number would fall, positive rates for exome sequencing have been reported from 25% to above 40% from multiple sources. Just to throw out some specific examples, you could check out The Usefulness of Whole Exome Sequencing in Routine Clinical Practice by Alejandro Iglesias et al. In Genetics and Medicine from 2014, where they reported about a 32% positive rate, or Practical Considerations in the Clinical Application of Whole Exome Sequencing by Shashi et al. In Clinical Genetics from 2015, where they found a rate of about 26%. And a PubMed search would find you plenty more papers quoting positive rates from that range. So at this point, let's say we've convinced the skeptic that exome sequencing can find them a positive result. They've seen all these papers and they see, yeah, consistently they are finding some positive results. They're probably wondering how expensive this is going to be. Is exome sequencing a cost-effective way to end the diagnostic odyssey? Perhaps my favorite paper to show people who are skeptical of the cost-effectiveness of exome sequencing is another paper by Vandana Shashi et al. Called The Utility of the Traditional Medical Genetics Diagnostic Evaluation in the Context of Next-Generation Sequencing for Undiagnosed Genetic Disorders. And this paper was from 2013. In this study, a group from Duke University Medical Center did a retrospective chart review based on 500 consecutive patients that they saw in their clinic. And these patients were evaluated using what they called traditional medical genetics diagnostic evaluation, by which they meant things like microarray and single gene testing or targeted gene panels, as well as biochemical and other traditional diagnostic studies. Basically, they were just referring to everything that's not exome or genomic testing. What they found was that about 46% of their patients received a genetic diagnosis from that cohort of 500, but the key finding was that 72% of the people who were diagnosed at visit 1, and another 18% were diagnosed at visit 2. So 90% of their patients who received a diagnosis received it in one of those first two visits. Now, this confirms something I suspect most of us already understood. Clinical geneticists and their teams are quite good at their jobs. I mean, patients walk into their doors often with little to go on, but with their knowledge and expertise, these teams will send more than 40% of these families out the door with an answer by the second visit. I mean, I certainly remember being consistently impressed by how knowledgeable the medical geneticist was and how well the team was able to operate and find answers and help families. When I rotated through the pediatrics clinic at Robert Wood Johnson in New Jersey, shout out to Dr. Susan Brooks and her team, by the way. The other thing this data tells us, though, is that after those first few visits, diagnosis rates fall off rapidly. That is to say, once our clinical genetics teams have had a chance to apply that knowledge that they have, they're often left just running through tests trying to find an answer among diseases that didn't really pique that initial instinct. And Shashi et al. Show us that this process can be expensive. They added together the costs of lab testing for the patients in their cohort and found that while the average cost for diagnosis was about $4,700, if you took out all the patients who received a diagnosis at the first visit and just looked at the 28% who received a diagnosis in the second visit or after, the mean cost for diagnosis rose to just over $25,000. Notably, an Exome Next trio at Ambry will cost you less than a quarter of that. And let's not forget that these are just testing costs. They're not even taking into account the time these families take off from work to get to multiple appointments, or the transportation costs they incur, or any of the other costs that can build up while patients are on that diagnostic odyssey. Let's remember, the ACMG recommended exome sequencing be considered in cases where past testing has failed to provide a diagnosis in a disorder that is suspected. Based on their numbers, Shashi et al. Recommend that exome testing should be considered when, quote, traditional approaches do not result in a diagnosis after the first visit to a genetics clinic. And they also said that, quote, its timely application would result not only in a higher rate of genetic diagnosis, but a considerable cost savings per successful diagnosis. Lest you think that type of conclusion wouldn't replicate, there is a study from Soden et al. In Science and Translational Medicine called Effectiveness of Exome and Genome Sequencing Guided by Acuity of Illness for Diagnosis of Neurodevelopmental Disorders. Now, they did a study where they did whole exome sequencing for patients with non-acute neurodevelopmental disorders and found that, based on the rate at which they were able to find a diagnosis among these patients and the mean total cost of testing for the families, exome testing was cost-effective up to a price of $7,640 per family, which, notably, about $2,000 more expensive than ordering an exome next would cost. And like in the Shashi paper, Soden et al. Conclude by suggesting, quote, sequencing of genomes or exomes of trios should become an early part of the diagnostic workup of neurodevelopmental disorders, end quote. So not only do exomes find answers, they do it in a cost-effective enough way that it makes sense to start considering them as early as a second visit once the first-line inquiries have proven fruitless. What if this isn't enough, though? What if, despite your pleas of cost-effectiveness, your skeptic is still unsure? Maybe they're thinking, yeah, well, this exome may find us an answer, but so what? Will it actually change anything about the patient's healthcare? Well, first, I might caution them to not underestimate the relief and sense of possibility for the future that an answer can give to families, even if it doesn't cause an immediate change in medical management. But that said, the paper by Soden et al. Took a look at the changes in medical management that happened in their patients who received a positive exome and found that the diagnosis changed patient management or clinical understanding of the disease pathophysiology in about half of the patients who received a diagnosis. The truth is, it's difficult for me to put myself in the shoes of an exome skeptic. The good news is that there are less and less of them these days. The signs of progress as far as adoption are everywhere. And in fact, as I was putting together research and doing some of the writing for this very podcast, the insurance company Cigna came out with formal insurance guidelines for whole exome sequencing. From my perspective, though, I spend so much time working with exomes and seeing the good that we're doing for myself or reading the literature that others have written on the topic that it's tough for me to see that mindset. But I hope today I did an adequate job of addressing the concerns that someone who is still skeptical might have. If I didn't, I at least hope I've demonstrated that there is a ton of excellent and recent research showing how exome can be effective and exploring some of its limitations. And I hope I've given you a jumping-off point for exploring more yourself. If you feel there was something here I didn't address that I should have, or maybe another paper you feel like should have been talked about, or you just have more general feedback to give me, my email is cgund@ambrygen.com. That's cgund@ambrygen.com. My name is Christian Gund. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you next time.